Good evening. On behalf of the Vice Provost and Director of Libraries, H. Carton Rogers, and my colleague, Will Knoll, Director of the Kislak Center for Special Collections, Rare Books and Manuscripts, and the Schoenberg Institute for Manuscript Studies, welcome to the 2014 ASW Rosenbach Lectures in Bibliography. Although established in 1928, the first Rosenbach Lectures were given in the fall of 1931 by author, journalist, and bibliophile Christopher Morley. Over the course of five evenings, Morley delivered five talks under the title Ex Libris Erasmus, or Golden Florins, a Reading of 85 Books. There would be many Rosenbach Lectures to follow. Like many Penn alums, Rosie Rosenbach, America's greatest antiquarian book dealer and a devoted bibliographer, had the foresight to create a lecture series on the subject of descriptive bibliography. Rosenbach provided a substantial endowment to underwrite the costs of the annual series and enable the selection committee the means to attract the best speakers who are active in the broad field of book history, including the study of the materiality of texts and their physical production. Synonymous with the Penn Libraries, the Rosenbach Lectures are the oldest continuous lecture series of its kind in North America. Today, the Penn Libraries and the University of Pennsylvania Press are the co-sponsors of this prestigious lecture series. Since 1931, the Rosenbach Lectures have been delivered 63 times. The math may not add up, but during the decade of the 1940s, the lectures were only given five times. The nation was at war. The roster of past lecturers is a who's who of American book historians and bibliographers. To name only a few, the list includes, among others, A. Edward Newton, George Parker Winship, Dard Hunter, George Sarton, Fredson Bowers, Rosenbach's biographer Edwin Wolfe, Donald Pizer, Robert Darnton, Ruth Mortimer, Thomas Tanzel, Frederick Schreiber, James Green, Anthony Grafton, Peter Stalybras, and Elizabeth Eisenstein. Selecting Rosenbach lecturers is a challenging, affair, and the committee includes Penn professors Peter Stalybras and Rita Copeland, Jerry Singerman, University of Pennsylvania Press, and representing the Kislak Center, William Knoll, Dan Traister, John Pollock, and myself. We meet several times a year, and the committee will be meeting shortly to draw up our short list of candidates for future Rosenbach lectures beyond next year. In March 2015, independent scholar and eminent book collector William Zaks will deliver the 2015 Rosenbach lectures. In contrast to the five nights of lectures delivered by Christopher Morley in 1931, this year's lecturer, Harvard professor Ann Blair, is giving only three lectures. Professor Blair will be lecturing this evening, tomorrow night, and her third concluding talk will be given on Thursday evening. I'd like to remind you that concluding tonight's lecture, there is a reception in honor of our speaker, and the reception will take place in the southwest corner of the Kislak Center. Without further ado, I would like to ask Professor Roger Chartier, professeur in the Collège de France, and Annenberg Visiting Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania, and might I add, the 1994 Rosenbach lecturer, to introduce our speaker this evening, Professor Ann Blair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me begin with a question. Do you think that a book in which the main protagonists are Vincent Placius, Jeremias Drexel, and Francesco Sacchini, and the main topics, Polyanthea, Elenchi Titulorum, and note-taking, would be able to receive a review in the Washington Post, be selected among the favorite books of the year by the New Yorker, and be discussed in the show Talk to the Nation on NPR? It is very unlikely, isn't it? Except if this book is Ann Blair's Too Much to Know. I have known Anne since the beginning of her research for a PhD dissertation devoted to Jean Bodin's Universae Naturae Theatrum, a project that became her first book published in 1997 as The Theater of Nature, Jean Bodin and Renaissance Science. In this book, and already 5 years earlier, in an article published in the Journal of History of Ideas, Anne Blair was one of the first scholars to stress the central importance for humanist reading and writing practices of commonplacing, a technique that, and I follow her definition, entered and sorted under subject headings, interesting turns of phrase, opinions, or facts of all kinds, encountered in reading, travel, and daily life for later retrieval and use, end of quote. It is by using this technique that Bodin composed his Theater of Nature and that his readers read it, as it is shown by the annotated copies they left studied by Anne. 13 years after the book on Bodin, Anne Blair published the book I mentioned in my beginning, Too Much to Know, Managing Scholarly Information Before the Modern Age. The second book was devoted to the reference books, understood by Anne Blair as, I quote her, large collections of textual material consisting typically of quotations, examples, or bibliographic references, used in many times and places as a way of facilitating access to a mass of text considered authoritative. End of quote. She analyzed with impressive erudition and lively imagination both the multiple genres, florilegia, polyanthea, encyclopedic works, books as bibliothecae, and the intellectual and material practices that allow Renaissance scholars to cope with the overabundance of books, to use finding devices, to take and organize notes in order, I quote her, to pick and choose from among these treasuries something to suit their needs and to integrate in their own knowledge production. Too Much to Know was praised by academic reviewers and readers, but it also captured, as I said, the attention of the general media because it deals historically with the anxiety created by the worrying overload information of our digital present, and because it traces the genealogy of contemporary techniques used by information management. As the reviewer of the Washington Post observed, if you like to know things, even in a world in which there is already too much to know, Blair's book is a mini library in itself. Supported by these two fundamental pillars, Anne Blair's bibliography is impressive. She has published 50 articles, all based on original research, and she has co-edited 3 volumes. Her scientific excellence was recognized in 2001 by the tenure professorship she received at Harvard, where she came as assistant professor from the University of California at Irvine in 1996, and also this scientific excellence was recognized by the MacArthur Fellowship that allowed her to complete Too Much to Know. Her exceptional scholarship is admired all around the world, including France, because she always articulates in her work the history of science and knowledge, in her case, Renaissance natural philosophy, intellectual and religious history. She is currently working on a book devoted to the tension between natural theology and biblical exegesis, and the history of both scribal culture and print culture. Her services on editorial boards of prestigious journals, our Journal of the History of Idea, the Journal of Modern History, or the Bibliothèque d'Humanisme et Renaissance, and on advisory boards, for example, at the Rare Book School in Virginia, show the importance and originality of her expertise in our academic and intellectual world. A Rosenbach lecture are titled Hidden Hands, Amanuensis and Authorship in Early Modern Europe. They promise us a deep reappraisal of our knowledge about textual production. Indeed, in recent decades, historians have focused their attention on the different agents involved in the publication of the books, from the author or the authors in all forms of collaborative authorship, to the first readers, publishers, copy editors, compositors, correctors, but perhaps forgotten were other decisive contributors who also participated in the production not only of the books, but also, and more fundamentally, of the texts themselves. Anne Blair called amanuenses these invisible collaborators who indeed took down dictated compositions, but whose roles was not limited to this task. Far from it. By acknowledging the importance of these hidden hands in the composition and circulation of scholarly works, she will oblige us, once again, to consider in a new perspective what is authorship in a late modern Europe, to paraphrase Foucault, in a time when the promotion of the author's names on title pages and frontispieces was accompanied and perhaps made possible by the invisibility of all those who helped them. I am very glad to welcome Anne Blair for this 2014 Rosenbach Lecture, which she will deliver today, tomorrow, and on Thursday. The first one is entitled Hidden Helpers. Please, before taking notes and excerpting commonplaces, please welcome with me Professor Anne Blair.
Something else I've forgotten to do is just turn off my phone. Well, thank you so much, Roger. I, too, remember that first seminar, Thursday, 10 a.m., in fall of 1988. You were such a welcoming hub of book history in Paris, and I think I feel I am in a hub of book history that here at Penn, which is a model for us in the Boston area, which we strive to imitate. I'm thrilled to be here in this beautiful space, in a great library surrounded by friends and students of books in historical or bibliographical modes. And certainly I've had my share of doubts about the wisdom of accepting this weighty invitation. But as I've worked toward these lectures in the past couple of years, what has sustained me is knowing that there would be a fantastic audience with whom to dialogue over these few days. So thank you for coming. So I'll be talking as Roger. I needn't give the talk. You spelled it all out right there. But I will nonetheless. So I'm going to talk about how scholars and authors in early modern Europe relied on helpers of various kinds, whom they often did not acknowledge. So I'm keenly aware in pursuing this topic of all the help that I have received. And honestly, in this topic more than any other, I have gleaned from the comments of interlocutors at formal and informal occasions, and so I'm especially looking forward to your comments. I've also drawn on exciting scholarship, some of it older, but a lot of it quite recent, in many related directions, studies of authorship and collaborative authorship, of relations with authors with printers and the many people involved in making a book, in editorial acts is a current term, that books aren't the only way to communicate things. Studies of specific authors like Erasmus or Montaigne, more general studies of the role of manuscript in the handpress era, of the habitus of scholars and servants, and on the Republic of Letters with its hierarchies as well as its egalitarian ideals. So thank you for coming, and special thanks to all those who made my visit possible. We heard about the Rosenbach Committee, David Knight, Will Noel, John Pollack, Peter Stalibras, Roger Chartier, and of course, A.S.W. Rosenbach, and no doubt others hidden whom I don't know about. Thank you. So as others have emphasized in various contexts, intellectual work in early modern Europe, perhaps in any period, is often social and collaborative. We know from literary scholars about the role of collaborative playwriting in the era of Shakespeare, about the role of coterie of salonnières in 17th century France in early novel writing. My focus will be mostly on scholarship, late humanism, rather than literature, but nonetheless, authors figure too. Humanists thought of themselves as part of a republic of letters, in constant intellectual sociability, with their sources on the one hand, the long-dead ancients, and with live peers with whom they exchanged letters, books, references, observations, and so forth. Collaborative scholarship was sometimes formalized in a few large-scale ventures, such as ecclesiastical histories, antiquarian compilations, philosophical commentary, biblical translation, academic dictionaries. These are the classic genres of what Vincent Placius, one of my favorite authors, called social books, libri sociales, which he praised and thought were associated with the new academies, but he also noted that they are difficult because of the dissension among men. So explicitly collaborative works are a really small phenomenon in early modern Europe. In any field, of course, a printed work involved its author in interaction with others who produced the book. As Roger Stoddard, channeled by Roger Chartier, noted, authors don't make books, printers do. And a remarkable spate of recent work by Anthony Grafton, Martine Furneaux, Raphael Morin, Alexandre Van Outgaarden, among others, has emphasized how many other people beyond even the printers were involved in those editorial acts, to use a term used by Anne Riach-Ngo. So friends and family, patrons, editors, censors, compositors, correctors, etc. Sometimes these interactions were ongoing, and other times not. Some authors never set foot in the printing house, in fact. Others were closely involved. Relations were also variable, and even in the same relationship could move from hot to warm at different times. So my focus will be on a cast of what one might think of more intimate helpers, people involved in the production of the working texts and the manuscripts, especially before publication. And I'm using the term amanuensis to encompass a range of helpers, from paid secretaries and servants to students and family members. The boundaries of the category are, of course, completely blurry. They blur into friends and peers on the one hand, and into other helping roles played, for example, by people in the printing house. And my question in this lecture, inspired by Stephen Chapin's seminal 1989 article called The Invisible Technician, in which he talks about those invisible people who manipulated the instruments performed in the experiments by the Royal Society coterie, is to think about the conditions under which these amanuenses, these invisible technicians of text, become visible, how they were visible at the time to each other, and, of course, to us today as historians. So recent scholarship has emphasized the plural and collaborative nature of authorship, but the early modern period was certainly also a time of newly explicit depictions of the author or scholar as a heroic individual, heroic because of rhetorical skill, probing self-examination, exacting scholarship, diligent labor, endless sleepless nights spent studying, as people boast in their prefaces. These new conceptions and self-conceptions of authorship were in part inspired by ancient models, as highlighted by studies of self-fashioning or a new trend called career criticism. But I quite like, so the idea that Virgil's the Rota Virgiliana is an inspiration to early modern authors. Horace's ambition in his odes, for example, to have erected a monument to outlast the pyramids of Egypt, resonated powerfully with many humanistic-minded poets. An early example was Petrarch, who started his letter to posterity, composed circa 1372, with the observation that, contrary to what some might think, he was a mere mortal, in fact. Richard Helgerson has coined the term self-proud laureates to describe the way, a couple hundred years later, Spencer, Johnson, and Milton viewed themselves as poets above the ordinary ranks of either entertainers or professional writers, whose mission was to revive an ancient ethos of poetry to make a national or Christian literature. On the Christian side, Jerome was another model of the scholar whom many humanists followed. Famously, Erasmus, as argued especially by Lisa Jardine, depicted working alone with a few books, sometimes with a companion animal. I'm not sure, honestly, what the peacock's doing there. We can talk about the companion animals in the question period. I look forward to your suggestions. So here, the emphasis on the heroic author is vividly conveyed in iconographic, the media of the day. And one of the new media is, of course, oil painting. Another is medals, and of course, print. And some of these images become iconic, widely imitated, and they've remained so since then, and I think they are part of this obscuring of how work actually happened with other people. Alongside these portrayals, though, and the invisibility of the helpers, we also have evidence, more evidence than in earlier periods, I would argue, from the Renaissance, about how people worked with others. One reason is the increased survival of personal papers, letters, annotated books, starting in the Renaissance. Even though, as Roger Chartier has argued in his most recent book, Printer's Mind, Author's Hand, surviving papers of canonical literary figures are rare before the 18th century, For scholars, we have a remarkable number of significant literary remains, from Poliziano to Erasmus, Guillaume Budet, Joseph Scaliger, grounds that Tony Grafton, among others, has tilled so effectively. We have similar troves of material for the reformers, for example, or for the scholars in the ambit of the Royal Society studied by Michael Hunter and others. So these nachlässe, these literary remains, survive thanks to the intentions of the principals themselves, the note-takers, the readers, the authors, and then, of course, of their heirs, who intended to accumulate and save and preserve and transmit them, usually got them into some institution where they kind of moldered for a while. In addition, of course, there were many unintentional factors that contributed to made possible this survival, notably the shift to paper as a medium for drafts and private notes, which made those things very durable, which otherwise might have been written on temporary surfaces and not have survived. And of course, the simple luck of escaping destruction from fire, flood, inadvertent or intentional human destruction. So from these personal papers, letters, notebooks, drafts, in various hands, we can see that scholars did not work alone. And throughout this project, I'm deeply indebted to the many editors of letters and papers who have mastered the hands and the habits of specific writers and those in their circle. For example, Michael Hunter identified 11 different hands in the papers of Robert Boyle, none of them Boyle's own. Another reason for the glimpses we catch of helpers in the Renaissance was the increasingly common practice of addressing the reader in paratext in a more personal tone, or sometimes in the text itself, making passing remarks that imply the existence of helpers. And just to convince you that there were helpers where we might not expect them, before I get started, here's an example from Montaigne, who is widely viewed, of course, as one of the most explicit and introspective authors about his writing, never addresses head-on the fact that he had helpers. But this is the Bordeaux copy of the 1588 edition, the last to appear in his lifetime, which he filled with additions, mostly, that were used by his fille d'alliance, Marie de Gournay, to publish posthumously the 1595 edition, known as C. If you buy a modern edition, there's A, 1580, B, 1588, C, 1595. So mostly it's adding. But here is a passage that's been cut. So, of course, what happens to it? In 1595, it's not there. In a modern translation, it ends up in a footnote. It was there. What does this passage say? It's in Essays of the Arms of the Parthians, and it comes right after. He talks about how Marcellinus tells us that the Parthians had a strange way of arming themselves, and Montaigne, in this cut passage. I intended to take this passage from its author, having once taken the trouble to say very amply what I knew about the comparison of our armor with Roman armor. But this scrap of my notes having been stolen from me, with several others, by a man in my service, I will not deprive him of the profit he hopes to make from it. Also, it would be very hard for me to chew over the same meat twice. So, in this strange moment of self-reflection, he lets slip that he has people in his pay who have access, probably wrote down some of these things, and then he has stolen it, hoping to sell it, presumably. So this is the kind of aside, but of course he then canceled it. We can wonder why he got rid of it, whereas in fact his goal, as George Hoffman would argue, was to augment the essays in order to renew the privilege just in time for the lapse of the previous privilege. So in these lectures I've collected evidence from different kinds of sources about the work that authors delegated to others or performed with the help of others. In preparing texts or manuscripts, I also talk about the kinds of people and the kinds of relationships involved. So my purpose is to approach from a slightly different angle the question that has motivated much recent scholarship. What were the working practices of authors and scholars? Their methods of reading, of note-taking, composing, revising? Ultimately, what are the traces left of their thinking process? At the same time, this project also hinges on visibility and invisibility. And examining when and why helpers are mentioned has seemed to me to shed interesting light on ideas and practices of credit and authority, during a period when the rise of the printed book created new opportunities for public credit, on the one hand, new stresses around being mentioned in public, and new pressures for market success, on the other. Specifically, helpers were convenient to invoke or to ventriloquize through whenever the author would like to maintain the option of blaming someone for problems or the option of plausible deniability for something. So underlying these lectures is an ongoing concern, in fact, about the impact of printing, which has been driving book history since the self-conscious coalescence of this field about 30 years ago. So in this lecture, Hidden, I'll focus on when and why we catch glimpses, and what kinds of glimpses, and this is the prettiest lecture. I think you can say that to all. If you don't come back, you got the prettiest one. On Tuesday, hands, I'll focus on what the helpers did and how they interacted, and that's the most example-filled. On Thursday, I'll try to pull together some conclusions about the impact of print on practices of thanking and attributing, of giving and offloading credit, and that's maybe the most sort of trying to reach some broader conclusions. Oh, yeah. So I don't want to exaggerate what's unique to the 16th and 17th centuries, even though I'll focus on those centuries. Helpers were essential long before and long after this period, with striking continuities, the same persistent tensions surrounding trust, delegation, unauthorized circulation, and changes, extent of private and public recognition. So before focusing on the representation of the author in the early modern period, I wanted to consider some representations of authorship in sort of a bird's eye survey of the European tradition before. So in ancient Greece and Rome, help from above consisted of help from the muses, regularly invoked in literary texts, and you'll see this is a specific literary text from the time. Or we get depictions of the author alone with his works. Imperial and other high-ranking patrons were thanked in dedications for their support, past and future, by Roman authors, but I'm not aware of any representations of that act of an author addressing a patron. As William Johnson has emphasized, the production of many texts in late Republic and early Empire in Rome also had a strong social element. When authors gave trial readings of their work to a circle of friends, in a banquet, for example. So here I have a depiction of a banquet. And Johnson makes the case that Cicero changed the structure and voice of his De Republica as a result of symposiastic criticism. Sadly, I don't think any reading is happening here, but something that's very cool is the guy in the center holding up the chicken. I equate him with a kind of servant I learned about in doing this research. The meat carver was a specially high-paid, high-skill servant position in major ecclesiastical households in Rome. And Laurie Nussdorfer has talked about this. So I see here the antecedent of the meat carver taking a prominent role in this scene. And of course, they're lacking someone to sweep up, apparently. Here is one depiction, of course, of another social environment in which texts were produced in antiquity, which would be Plato's Academy. Obviously, this much postdates the actual Academy. But you can see an ancient vision of how texts can be produced collectively. And in antiquity, there were helpers from below. The educated slave was a unique ancient institution, partly sustained by the need to have two hands in managing scrolls, especially given the ancient predilection for holding scrolls on your lap rather than on a flat surface like a desk. So here we can see if you're busy reading, you can't be doing a whole lot else. You're not also going to be writing. So in fact, much reading would happen by being read to. Educated slaves, I have a quote from Pliny. Pliny's the nephew describes of his uncle that he was read to at all times, while bathing, while traveling, while taking meals. And of course, then if he had something to say, he would be dictating it also possibly to another educated slave. And when such dictation would happen on a wax tablet as a temporary surface and then copied into these papyrus rolls for permanent storage, and Pliny left his nephew 166 rolls written in a fine hand on both sides, which Pliny passed on to his nephew, having refused to sell them to someone who was offering 400,000 sesterces, which is quite a tidy sum for these notes. What happened to them after that? Unfortunately, I think no early Christian copyist decided that Pliny's notes was worth putting onto parchment. So that's why we have basically very few notes, some charred remains in Herculaneum. Notwithstanding from the ancient period. Of course, we have a famous example of an educated slave, and that's Tyro, who's mentioned in 63 of 900 letters of Cicero that have come down to us. Tyro was manumitted in 53 and continued to work for Cicero as a free man, even to the detriment of his health, in multiple capacities as literary assistant, confidential secretary, financial agent, and crucially, as intellectual executor. When Cicero suspected he would face execution, he passed all his papers onto Tyro in the hope that Tyro would avoid that fate. And Cicero was right, and it's thanks to Tyro that we have Cicero's unpublished writings, such as his letters, and a good biography. Tyro, of course, is famous for supposedly having invented shorthand. Now scholars reject the idea that Tyro did so, but clearly shorthand was a common skill among amanuenses in this period, and what it was good at was excipere, to snatch, to capture words on the fly, exceptio. And so shorthand was useful for that. In later Roman Empire, an exceptor, which is not excerptor, right, minus the R that we get in the Renaissance, is the person who excerpts. This is someone who snatches on the fly, who takes notes from oral events, was an official who would record the decisions of a magistrate. So here, this position and that of notarius held considerable dignity, and we can see here a magistrate with two exceptors, and then down below, the people who were petitioning. And, So whether slaves or freemen, plenty helpers were basically never named and barely mentioned, Tyro being a fascinating exception. But it's important to realize that Tyro is mentioned not in any of Cicero's published works. It's just the early modern humanists who treated Cicero's letters just like the Aeneid, you know, commenting on them just as much, but they were in fact private documents in the time. A recent book by Socha Carey on Pliny has brought our attention to, and actually Daniel Margoshi is the one who brought this book to my attention, the facade of the Cathedral of Como, the Pliny's hometown, which features from the 15th century two ediculi, Pliny the Elder and Pliny the Younger. And I have to say, I'm a big fan of Wikipedia, but they do make a mistake in getting the wrong Pliny labeled. So I feel, you know, I've made a contribution there. Under Pliny the Elder, we have two scenes relevant to his life, depicted by these 15th century Italian artists. So one is the eruption of Vesuvius. I think over on the right we have lava coming down, which of course killed Pliny in 79. And secondly, it seems to be Pliny and his workshop. Pliny is reading a codex, and there are a bunch of guys, assistants, sort of ready at the waiting. Now, whether this is inspired by a reading of the letters in which Pliny's working methods are described, or whether it's inspired by how people worked at the time in 15th century Italy, we won't exactly know. The anachronism, of course, of the form in which Pliny's roles are described suggests not a very close reading of that letter about the 166 papyrus rolls, but it was typical of humanist representations of ancient reading. I love this Cicero as a young boy. And I'm planning to pop this on an undergraduate exam someday. So you know, describe the anachronism here. Discuss. Moving on to the early Christian period, there are some important new ingredients to the concept of authority and authorship in late antiquity. Authoritative inspiration no longer came from the muses, but from the Holy Ghost. And at the same time, ordinary humans could not readily claim divine inspiration and were expected instead to emphasize their humility. In the practices of authorship, though, perhaps not much had changed. Peter Brown describes Augustine's method of producing texts this way. His stenographers would always be at hand taking down some treatise from dictation. His friends would always gather round him asking questions, needing help, demanding yet more and more books. They would snatch his great works from him in their first draft. Many such manuscripts circulated for decades in an incomplete form. But the way authorship is described, is depicted, for example, in this 8th century, basically the earliest Vulgate, near-complete Vulgate, produced at Weymouth Jarrow, is new. Rather than Virgil either getting piped information from the muses or sitting there with his stuff, we have the prophet Ezra, presumably modeled on Cassiodorus, actually writing in his own hand. And one commentator surmises that these nine books, which are lying on their side, are the nine manuscripts which Cassiodorus describes collating, quote, with the help of friends who read for him. So the act of scribing was ennobled by the Christian depiction of the redactors of the Bible writing under divine inspiration, and by high-ranking ecclesiastics who described themselves writing. Copying was an act of piety and humility. For example, the Venerable Bede notes in the preface to his commentary on the Gospel of Luke that he had to be at once author, scribe, and copyist. And indeed, he may have had a hand in scribing some of this manuscript. The central models, of course, for scribing are around the evangelist. So here we have a one-man operation. I like the idea that he's writing a codex, but he's got, I think, the scroll is often used to depict orality. So he has two media in front of him. And he's transferring something from orality, from the scroll, into a codex. But I could be over-reading there. Other times we have a more explicit. So here is God dictating to Moses in a 14th century Parisian depiction. So, of course, this sacralizes the act of writing, of scribing. The best people are doing this. Then I love these three-way acts, a chain of transmission. So we have the Holy Ghost in the upper right, who is speaking to John the Evangelist, who is then dictating to his scribe, Prochorus. This is a peculiarly Byzantine tradition. And you'll notice that everybody's got halos, so the scribe is just as holy or as John the Evangelist. Here's another one with, again, that shift of media, orality to scroll, and then Prochorus is has his codex in hand. I do have a pointer that I might get into. So normally, in these special cases, of course, sacred scribes are probably modeled in their postures and activities on actual scribes, but their work was of a completely different order than what normal scribes do. That was beyond reproach. And by contrast, actual medieval scribes are very much men and typically criticized for error, and that's and usually not depicted, except when they mess up. So here is a very rare depiction of a particular incident told in a life of Gregory from 300 years after his death, attributed to pseudo-Paul the Deacon, which tells this incident. While Gregory was dictating to his exceptor, he became silent, and the scribe became curious. So he took his stylus, and he poked a hole in the curtain to see what was going on. And he saw the holy dove in conversation with the Pope. Gregory was angered by his action and swore him to secrecy throughout Gregory's lifetime, hence the 300-year delay in telling the story. That's my codicil. So the story is a classic modesty trope in which Gregory hides his divine inspiration with the curtain and doesn't want anybody to know. Excuse me. And perhaps the curtain is an exceptional piece of equipment in this scholarly setup. But on the other hand, if you look through these slides, there are a lot of curtains out there, so I'm on a hunt for curtains. Maybe it's a way of keeping your desk warm, just the way you'd put a curtain around a bed. I don't know. Anyways, it's very useful for this. And clearly, the dove and the curtain become the trappings of Gregory, as we see here in this depiction of him dictating hymns in a hymnal. So the curtain, of course, and the dove are there. One kind of scribe we do hear about explicitly in the Middle Ages are the male confessors who took down the words of inspired female mystics. Marjorie Kemp, for example, required a scribe both to take down her visions and to lend authority and clerical legitimacy to her experiences. She worked with three different male amanuenses, including her own son, and a priest who was inconsistent in his loyalty to her controversial cause. The book of Marjorie Kemp begins with a prologue written by the priest amanuensis himself. A few scribes, of course, left colophons containing their names and sometimes images of themselves. I love this Gouda, brought to my attention by Eric Quackel's wonderful blog. So from a 12th century German convent. But also there are limits on the explicit limitations on this practice. I learned from my colleague Tom Bisson that Robert de Torigny, when he became abbot at Mont-Saint-Michel in 1200, forbade the scribes there from providing their names on their work the way they had before, presumably to enforce humility. So major ecclesiastics routinely relied on scribes. Bernard of Clairvaux's sermons were excepta. They were taken down from oral delivery by a secretary, vetted by Bernard before being circulated. Bernard also delegated significant letter writing to his aides, jutting from one apology to a correspondent in which he explained that his scribes, quote, sometimes forgot his meaning and sharpened their style beyond measure. Unless we want to interpret that passage as one of those cases of plausible deniability, when Bernard got negative response from his correspondent, he pushed it off on the scribe. But nonetheless, the way he formulates this is something a scribe could be expected to do. We do have a few autograph manuscripts from the 13th century, and here is a sample of Aquinas's Scriptura Inintelligibilis. And I suppose if you're a scribe being asked to make a clean copy of this or to take dictation, you would opt for taking dictation, which is certainly how Aquinas composed after the earliest part in his career from which the few autographs survive, treated sort of as relics after his death. He was assigned multiple companions to serve as assistants and secretaries while traveling and at home. Aquinas reportedly had the ability, considered miraculous, to dictate to three or four secretaries at once. He would also apparently let others fill out his quotations. The most important of his secretaries was Reginald of Paperno, who was constantly in attendance, even taking dictation in the middle of the night, especially noted for his skill at reportationes, that's the exceptio, and who left some passages describing his work with Aquinas. and served as Aquinas' literary executor. Other evidence we have comes from close analysis of surviving texts, for example, of the Ordinatio or Opus Oxoniense of John Duns Scotus. Scholars have concluded that probably Scotus only outlined the main parts of his treatise and entrusted his personal amanuensis or other scribes with the task of filling the text in, which explains why certain words were deleted that should have been copied, or why phrases or words were added that could hardly have been intended. And it also accounts for unusual turns of phrase that don't appear elsewhere. So that, you know, that's more thin evidence. Nonetheless, that's often what we have to go on. Scribes certainly played a huge role in bearing the blame for error, and especially in medieval biblical scholarship, recently studied in a nice book by Cornelia Lindy. The Bible itself, the Vulgate, is flawless, of course, and yet the copies we have of it have some problems. And so the key to preserving the flawlessness of the original Vulgate is the long transmission through anonymous scribes who have larded the text with errors. Secular vernacular authors were also aware of scribes. The famous poem To Adam Scrivain is no longer thought to be by Chaucer, but nonetheless comes from his milieu in late 15th century England, articulates the crucial role of the scribe. I will not read it in Middle English. Adam, my scribe, if it should ever happen that you write Boece or Troilus anew, may you have scabs and scales under your locks, unless you copy in true fashion and accord with my lines. So often I must renew your work and correct and rub and scrape, and all is through your negligence and haste. So, the usual, castigating the scribe and also extremely aware of his dependence on the scribe. He can't diffuse a work without the scribe. Petrarch famously, too, bemoaned his need to rely on scribes. They were slow, quote, a book written in a few months cannot be copied in so many years. And negligent, quote, they do not copy what has been given to them, but write out something altogether different. Petrarch even felt that to rely on scribes dampened his ability to compose. They promise much, corrupt everything, produce nothing, which I feel this myself and think that others do, smothers the speaking of new ideas in many authors and inspires fear that your painstaking efforts will be defiled by the negligence of scribes. So Petrarch engaged in some copying of his own, making multiple autographs to circulate, but he also employed multiple scribes, noting at one point he used to have 5 or 6 copyists, but now I have 3. The reason for not having more is that one cannot find scribes, but only painters, and you have to hope they're competent. Petrarch's grumpy attitude was certainly not unique. When Poggio Bracciolini sent a copy of Statius Silva to Francesco Barbaro in 1418, he complained, "The man who copied the books was the most ignorant of living men. One needs to use divination, not reading itself. So it's very important that these books be copied by a scholar. I have read as far as the 13th book and corrected a lot, so it may be easy for someone writing it correctly to avoid similar mistakes." And in this case, unusually, we actually have a glimpse of the scribe who was none too happy about this relationship. The manuscript in question is extant in the Spanish National Library, digitized, featuring his querulous colophon. It's done, let me be paid, basically. So holy scribes were essential to making the sacred texts and were always considered admirable and trustworthy, but ordinary scribes were principally decried as necessary evils who controlled and distorted the text which they copied and yet were essential. Those scribes named and depicted themselves occasionally, authors and representations of authors, certainly did not. In shifting now to the early modern period, I think we see a lot of continuity amplified by new media. So here is an early oil painting, a Jerome in his study. I like the curtain, I like the lion, all kinds of goodies there. Again, the solitary author. This one has more, where's the anachronism in this one? I think this is supposed to be crumpled paper. Right, so, but of course Augustine wasn't writing on paper, but maybe papyrus crumples well too. I don't know. This one I actually did use on a test, but no one took the answer. No one, they chose the other one. I always provide options. Here's some more. Here, of course, Augustine is getting a vision, and we see the trappings of a top ecclesiastic set up with manuscripts probably shelved here, I've been told, statuettes, of course, all kinds of antiquities. Not a whole lot of books, actually, when you think about it. So now turning to Erasmus, who's going to be a recurring theme throughout these lectures. He, in one of his first sort of self-representations, a title page that he surely had a hand in designing, he's not depicted at all, but his interlocutors are depicted, the ones he wants to be remembered for interacting with. the ancients, Romans and Greeks. But then Erasmus also was the author, in many ways, the designer of tons of representations of himself. Alexandre Van Uytgeerden has a very nice little book called Autoportrait d'Erasme. These aren't things that Erasmus made of himself. He wasn't an artist, but he designed them. We have 38 surviving portraits of Erasmus. I will show you only a small sample. Hans Holbein in Basel actually kept a model on, sort of a sketch, so that he could crank out other portraits on demand. So Erasmus, of course, the themes are constant. He also used a medal, stamped a medal of himself. I don't know if this is the first scholar to do that. Here, so why so many portraits? One of the things he used them for was as thank you gifts. So William Warham, Archbishop of Canterbury, was one of Erasmus's first and most constant patrons, giving him, starting in 1509, when Erasmus was very young, an annual stipend of £20, which continued until the Archbishop's death in 1532. So, of course, this is an economy of gift and counter-gift. So, also, Erasmus might be invited to attend someone at court, and instead of going, Erasmus would send a portrait. You can see that Erasmus depicts himself here with his own books. Here is a stained glass window, apparently still extant in the 18th century, but no longer now, with Erasmus's motto and symbol. Erasmus was very excited to be portrayed by Dürer, but he was disappointed in the result. He felt it didn't look like him. And here we are more and more. You get the gist of it. In the early modern period, so here is a heroic author, obviously. We do also get the scribe, the holy scribe. And here is a painting that no longer survives, but which, though it was refused by the church that had commissioned it, it was sold to a perfectly nice price. We needn't feel sorry for Caravaggio about it. It depicts quite bluntly how Matthew was a fisherman, and he could barely hold a pen, apparently. So the angel's busy, you know, telling him, work on your writing there. In addition to, whereas the painting that did get taken by the church and is still there, based on the commission, is much more abstract. So the angel is telling him what, point one, point two, what to say, not actually writing it for him. And finally, in that vein, we get an even more abstract representation of the role of an angel, just sort of breathing something into the ear, like the dove, but who isn't even in the field of vision of the evangelist. So we have this kind of depiction of scribes. And then finally, we have a very few. This is the only one I'm aware of. I'd love to hear about others. This is the painting which was explicitly used in the print used to advertise this talk, which I used in the dust jacket for Too Much to Know. And I'll give you a little book bibliographical interest. The first printing of Too Much to Know is not as nice as the second printing. For the second printing, so I have a little blurb on the dust jacket explaining the image, and I talk about the messy office and all the manuscripts and the books and the helper. Notice that maybe you don't see the helper. The helper is not wearing a hat, he's sitting on a stool. The main guy is wearing a hat, sitting in an armchair. But the point is, this is a satire, and I added that for the second printing. This is not anybody's idea, even though I love it as a vindication of the mess that my office is. It is not anybody's idea of what a good scholar is doing in the early modern period. Erasmus is a good scholar. This guy is a charlatan. And the way you can tell is the mess, and I would argue, the helper. So there we have this 18th century print engraving, which is really after the painting, very explicitly. You can see the phenomenon, of course, of copying and then printing from, which inverts the image. I did a little bit of find the differences and found a couple, a map, which doesn't seem to me to be visible, and then this sort of, I don't know what it is, medallion is positioned slightly differently on the wall. But basically, it's very faithful. And so it shows that this image of, you know, the crank with his assistant is still viable, vivid, in the 18th century. From the late 17th century, here's from Steve Chapin's The Invisible Technician. Turns out there aren't a whole lot of books that I've found, this is unique, that depict Putti running scientific apparatus. But it is a beautiful illustration of the point. Of course, there'll be people doing that, but rather than show people doing that, you abstract them and make them into Putti. The only other Putti scene I've found, and it's very appropriate to Philadelphia, is a small painting, apparently meant as a mock-up for a big one that never happened, where we have the putti, and one of them is dressed as a Native American. But by the 18th century, so here I'm drawing on Marcus Krajewski, Der Diener, 2010, which I think is underway in English translation to come out before too long. He makes the point that basically in painting, you don't find servants being depicted, period. And an exception is Veronese's now called Feast in the House of Levi, which was supposed to be a Last Supper. And you can see it's very Last Supper-y. But of course it isn't, because it's got all this extra stuff. It's got people fooling around and, you know, and servants, and it's not dignified enough. And the Inquisition apparently told him to rename the painting, which he did. So it shows that the presence of servants downgrades something. It's not what a painting is supposed to do. But that does change. By the 18th century, we have, of course, genre painting with, you know, milkmaids and various individuals. But I've selected just a couple, drawing on Krajewski, of the sort of intellectual helper. So this one, a servant reading to Madame Geoffrin, who ran a famous salon in 18th century Paris. So the servant is interestingly invisible to her, though visible to us, and of course audible to her. And this one, Goethe with his, with his Schreiber, Johann August Friedrich John, or John, I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, was a longtime secretary of Goethe's, serving from 1813 to 32. Goethe had multiple servants at one time, and a number of different secretaries, and famously, he called all his servants by the same first name, Karl. So there is a way in which he's anonymizing his servants. Georg Paul Goetze served Goethe for 17 years, and his handwriting became so like Goethe's that experts had difficulty telling them apart. Another servant, Philip Seidel, was described by a near contemporary as imitating Goethe's mannerisms, his way of speaking, and intonation. So such was the powerful impact that Goethe had on his surroundings. That's sort of the subtext of these stories. Goethe's most famous servant was his long-serving kammerdiener, a real Karl, Karl Wilhelm Stadelmann, whom Goethe asked to keep a day-by-day account of his life, an account book, who contributed specimens and observations to Goethe's collections of natural observations. This is a posthumous depiction by Schmeller, who knew Goethe well, would have had many encounters with Goethe before his death in 1832. And what's fascinating is we're talking about, obviously, the rise of the author's genius. No one will deny that for Goethe in 1800. And so why now suddenly do we have not a full face, but a three-quarter face depiction of the scribe? How interesting, is there a real interest in how the great man worked? Or is the sense that the genius is so great that even depicting his helper is not going to detract from him in any way? So in any case, this is a very favorable portrait. I don't think anybody would think it's satire or mocking Goethe. So it poses interesting questions. As the rise of the author as genius, suddenly we start to see for the first time some of the helpers. So in this bird's eye survey, authors acknowledged special helpers, muses, Holy Ghost, collaborators who enhanced their prestige. Holy scribes, everyone agreed, existed, but only in the past. Regular helpers are generally invisible over a long swath of history. Mention of the ancient Tyro occurs in private letters that it's only the humanists who made a lot of play with. But I would argue that though they're hard to see, helpers are probably more visible in the early modern period than before, rather than less so. And as I'll suggest in the next lecture in more detail, they're also probably less common, less ubiquitous in the early modern period than in earlier periods. So again, they become more visible as they become less prevalent. Why were they invisible? Obviously, a prevalent sense of hierarchy. Their role is to be invisible. They only become visible when something doesn't go right. The scribe who pokes a hole in the curtain, that's his fault. The scribe who makes a mistake, who gets sick. Oh yeah, Goethe's first reference to John is to complain that he was sick for 14 days. So he had to do his own work, or he had to postpone certain kinds of work. But I'd like to emphasize that helpers also effaced themselves, partly to maintain the status of a great man. Raphael Morin, who has studied the manuscripts of Pietro Vittori in the Vatican, which are mostly in the hand of his son, Jacopo, And Jacopo was part of a larger group that worked for the father, including students of his, and also Jacopo's son, Francesco. So at the death of the grandfather, Francesco is writing the Eloge. And he says, he boasts that his grandfather, unlike most humanists, worked alone, relying on a copyist at most to make a clean copy for the printer. So here is the one who knows most intimately how the great man worked, completely effaces himself. In the interest of preserving, he does better being the grandson of a great Vittori who worked alone than being a bit player in Vittori's workshop. So we see a similar kind of effacement without a family connection in the case of the commentaries of Pius II studied by Margaret Meserve, of which there is an autograph manuscript in the Vatican with a mix of hands, his own and his secretary. When Pius was near death, he gave the manuscript to his secretary Campano to make a fair copy and publish it and to correct as needed. Campano reports that mirabile dictu, everything was correct, no changes were needed. But in fact, he did make changes, as we can see from the surviving manuscript. That kind of self-effacement, of course, is alive and well today. Jack Stillinger, in Multiple Authorship and the Myth of the Solitary Genius, points to it's a trope among editors that they did nothing. William Maxwell Perkins, for example, claimed that he did nothing for F. Scott Fitzgerald, whereas he basically advised Fitzgerald to rewrite scenes and characters in The Great Gatsby. But the point is, the people who know the weaknesses of the author are the ones who have the most at stake by denying them in order to maintain their relationship with the author. Another reason some had for self-effacement was that they had risen from humble beginnings. And although that's a story we tell readily today, it wasn't one that Michelangelo wanted told about him by Vasari, that he had started as an assistant in Ghirlandaio's workshop. Would Vasari please remove this passage? But Vasari didn't. So when you make good from a humble beginning, you don't particularly, you'd like to erase that. I'll talk in a later lecture, mostly on Thursday, about how another reason to keep amanuenses anonymous is in order to be able to offload onto them complaints, blame for error, misfires, etc. So then it would be really invidious to name them and then criticize them on top of it all, often for things no doubt they didn't do necessarily. Certainly, of course, authors efface their helpers. There was an ideal that I'll talk about tomorrow also, that the amanuensis would imitate the master's handwriting, so no one would be able to tell that it wasn't the master himself. That's real effacement. But the notion of an author's talent or genius was clearly sufficiently developed in the Renaissance that there was something to be lost, apparently, in acknowledging the contributions of others, at least others who didn't have a special status. Adrien Bayet acknowledged many people who helped him in his life of Descartes in the late 17th century, and then comments, "Maybe a more sagacious author would have dissimulated all these great aids in order to look more original to his readers." So he's sort of having second thoughts, or obviously he's trying to boast that he isn't insecure, or he was being very generous. So that attitude toward acknowledging help, it might be compared to the attitude toward acknowledging and citing authorities. I love this passage in the Table Talk of John Selden, which is, of course, reported after his death by his secretary, Matthew Hale. So it is itself mediated through an amanuensis, at least one. "In quoting of books, quote such authors as are usually read. Others you may read for your own satisfaction, but don't name them. Quoting of authors is most for matter of fact, and then I write them as I would produce a witness, sometimes for a free expression, and then I give the author his due and gain myself praise by reading him." In other words, you cite an author when it makes you look good to cite that author, when it gives authority to what you're saying, a matter of fact, or a free expression that you're using. Helpers were probably expected to be invisible until the most recent periods. Now, of course, we have contracts that specify in great detail level of pay and acknowledgement on scientific papers with hundreds of authors, or of course, movie credits that now, you know, warrant a short movie of their own because there are so many forms of acknowledgement. And there are lots of conventions which Jack Stillinger, for example, having just one producer is something that's carefully negotiated. And if you don't get your name there, you get more money or whatever. So obviously we're used to thinking of this, all this is extremely explicit, but in this period, none of it is explicit. In the grand scheme of things, the early modern period may represent a shift to greater visibility of helpers, in fact, and certainly greater visibility of helpers to the historian, thanks to the survival of more personal papers. Greater visibility of helpers to their contemporaries, too, through the expanded circulation of letters and the availability of print, in which they did make fleeting appearances. I just want to close. There are many possible modern examples, but certainly hidden helpers are still there. And this is a case that came to my attention through an exhibit we had at the Radcliffe Institute called Take Note, where different libraries at Harvard were asked to contribute interesting examples of annotated works. And otherwise, I would never have known about it. So the Harvard Andover Theological Library has many, many books by Edward Everett Hale, who was a popular writer who literally published 5 to 10 books a year at his height in the late 19th century. Many of these books are co-authored. So here he's co-authoring with his son. Here he's co-authoring with his wife. And in the end, he's not, the final example. 11 copies contain notes to, from one of the authors to another, with his best love to her, inscribed to his personal assistant, Harriet E. Freeman. So he's saying, "This is, you are an author." From one of the author to another with his best love. And then I might say again, from one author to another, so much of this was printed from your pen. And now the shorthand is fascinating. First of all, that he knew the shorthand. I have worked hard on this shorthand. There are very few people who can read shorthand today. It is not Pittman. It's not Gregg. It's not standard shorthand. And as you might surmise, there was a bit more going on here than just a personal assistant. And it is surmised that this is a private sexual reference, because they were lovers. It's apparent and not apparent at the same time, even while he's co-authoring. And yet clearly, to be so productive, he relied heavily on her work. So thank you very much. I'll stop here for now. I look forward to your comments and questions. Thank you.
We have time for several questions, so who would like to pose the first? Yes, go ahead.
Seems to me that you are talking about two different kinds of helpers. One is someone who is the author's equal and who changes ideas and actually has a part in creating the book. The other kind of helper is the amanuensis or the scribe or the reader who might in secret improve the work, mm-hmm. or might make a suggestion or might know the author so well that he knows how to insert, but who is not on the surface and people. And it is not an equal exchange of ideas. Is that true?
Absolutely. I mean, by focusing on amanuenses, this is clearly a hierarchical relationship. I will mention a bit of the collaborative where so I have to contrast, because there are times when multiple people are acknowledged and who is being acknowledged. So that'll come out a bit more. But right, the amanuensis is in a hierarchical relationship. The master considers the amanuensis as a mechanical extension of self. The amanuensis, however, as you point out, is not a mechanical extension of the master. I have some nice examples of how, even with the master's blessing, is in fact offering feedback. And of course, how do you tell? That's one of the problems, because the people depict it in different ways. But I do think that many amanuenses were sounding boards and people with whom, or they thought, they were in an equal exchange with the master. The master probably never did. And you're absolutely right. That's built into this relationship, because it is a hierarchical one, and yet it's a very close one, because they spend a lot of time with each other and they share interests. And these amanuenses were often, obviously, the best ones were quite educated, and were experienced too. Might have done things, of course, that they'd been asked to do, like read a book that the author hadn't done. Yeah, thank you.
Peter?
Thanks very much, Anne. That's wonderful. Can I just ask about the sort of iconographic aspect of it? Because it seems to me there's a tension between the artistic tradition and the literary tradition. Mm-hmm. And the artistic tradition, by the Renaissance, there is this obsession, an increasing obsession, with the actual artist's hand. And so mm-hmm. the notion of tracking the artist's hand. And that seems to be extremely rare, actually, in the Renaissance. I mean, Roger's written about this in his new book,
right.
The Author's Hand and the Printer's Mind. I mean, Roger's argument is essentially it's the 18th century, you get literary archives,
right.
And that we project those back onto the earlier period. Now, of course, there are some people, who's Petrarch famously, mm-hmm. but the Montaigne is a classic example of Montaigne isn't preserving his manuscripts. There is no, we have, you know, Shakespeare's not preserving his manuscripts, whereas the norm is not to preserve the author's hand. Right.
Except if you're a humanist scholar.
Yeah, that's right.
then you do. Yeah, for authors.
The people we now think of
right.
as the kind of literary geniuses, you know,
yeah.
that by and large it's right. coincidence when we have their manuscripts.
Right.
So we have a paradox, it seems to me, which is the iconographic tradition is representing an author's hand
right.
that actually doesn't exist by and large.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, whereas the actual hand that does exist increasingly, and increasingly visibly with people like Rembrandt, is at least the fantasy, whether it's true or not is another whole question. But the fantasy that you're getting absolute Rembrandt's hand, and it's part of the contract, and it's part of the contractual relationship, is how much money you pay
right.
will actually relate to how much of the author's hand you're going to get.
Yeah.
So that you can pay more and get more of Rubin's hands, or pay less and get more of the workshop hands.
Yeah.
But no one's doing this, to my knowledge, to say, you know, like Molière, is anyone saying to Molière, you know, well, I really want your manuscript, and, you know, so you've got this paradox that we actually have only scribal labor, by and large,
right.
for the Renaissance, for the vast majority of these very important exceptions that you yourself have worked on. So
right.
it's encyclopedists, it's for us very odd people
yep.
whose manuscripts survive. So encyclopedists survive, humanists survive,
right.
You know, but for us, the people we expect to survive,
right.
John Donne, we have one single poem mm-hmm. in his handwriting, and it's
yep.
it was sent as a letter. And it was discovered in the 1950s. It was just
right.
lost, you know, went into someone's archive and so you discover it. But again, everybody talks about John Donne, and everybody
right.
talks about him writing. But
yep.
there's no interest in his handwriting.
Right.
And so it's the late 18th century, above all in England, but earlier mm-hmm. in France and Germany, that you suddenly get the emergence. And it's all, of course, it's all forgery. So
right.
Insofar as we have this, it's nearly all forgery. We have a wonderful collection of this here at Penn, including Shakespeare's hair and Anne Hathaway's hair, because of course you have to have it, you know.
Right. No, that's great. I will argue that the autograph is starting to count more
yes.
in the early modern period, and it's mainly in letters where autography is important, and where, you know, if you're writing to a family member or a close friend, it should be an autograph letter. Erasmus will apologize when Cousin, you know, has to write for him because he's ill. If you're writing up or down, you might use scribal because that's a sign of sort of respect, in fact. So I do think the handwriting is, you're right, why don't authors seem to value, or anybody seem to value, what they wrote in their own hand? Whereas I think that's right that when it comes to scholarly stuff, I think the reason that scholars hoard their notes is partly the idea that they'll be useful to someone else. And that they can be a dump. I mean, first of all, they're a treasury from which you will draw during your lifetime. Then you want to bequeath it to your offspring if you can, or maybe publish them in some form. That's what the adversaria are. You know, all these compilatory genres are basically just, you know, digging into your treasury and choosing some stuff to print up. Or that you'll be able, even if you don't publish anything, that you'll be able to share out, like Peiresc did in correspondence. Oh, I, you know, share out references to other people. And participate in the Republic of Letters. So it's useful. And I don't think scholars really care whose hand it is in, except that the annotated books of, say, Heinsius buys the annotated books that are annotated by Scaliger because he considers that, he wants to know what Scaliger thought. But of course, whether it's Scaliger's hand or if Scaliger were dictating, I don't suppose anybody really cared. So it's not the hand per se, it's just the great man's thoughts. Yeah, it's puzzling. Thank you.
Yes. Since you're dealing with a sense of self, the author and their helpers, would it be advisable also to think in terms of categories? Is there a difference between Catholics and Protestants? Is there a difference between the North and the South? And since you are basically speaking about Europe, it would help, I think, if we had a sense that something maybe else is happening here in terms of the development of self
yeah.
differently in one place from another.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. At this point, I've had, you know, it's been hard enough to get all the little goodies I have. So I mean, one source, I would say, for all of this is the educational system, humanist education. So the practices of taking dictation in class, of note-taking, of handwriting, all this discipline, which, of course, I'll talk about. The pedagogues think this is a really good thing. That's another emphasis on autograph, is that a child should be writing in his own hand over and over and over again, which wasn't probably something that was that emphasized in the Middle Ages. And certainly not, you know, Quintilian doesn't talk about teaching writing. He talks about teaching reading. So I think there's a lot of similarity, actually, between Catholic and Protestant, certainly. You know, it's amazing how the Academy of Geneva or Strasbourg or whatever and the Jesuits are really doing the same thing. Of course, you know, they're not commenting on the Bible in the same way, but actually, in all these sort of training years, they are reading the same ancient texts in basically the same ways. So I sort of see some grounds for seeing commonality. I mean, that's the Republic of Letters. That's the sort of, you know, a broadly shared undergirding, intellectual undergirding. Now, of course, you know, there's a huge difference between Petrarch and Boyle in terms of, you know, all kinds of things, but their sort of material circumstances, for example. And I will at some point have to weave that in better. But I'm not willing to overgeneralize. At this point, it's very hard to see patterns. I'm going to talk next time about how, you know, there's the big aristocratic household, there's a small-scale scholar household. There are patterns like that, obviously. And of course, one of the points to make is that the scholarly household is a very minority phenomenon. I mean, you know, there are just a handful of them compared to all the normal gentlemen's households where secretaries, there's one secretary and there are 40 servants. So whereas a scholarly household, like Erasmus, he's got one housekeeper and he's got eight amanuenses. So, you know, he's got a very different structure. Yeah, but thank you. I'll work on it.
Several more questions. One here and then one in the back. So go ahead.
Thanks, Dan. I was just curious, when do we have the first acknowledgments in the scholarly book? I think we'll be getting to that.
Yes, we will. Basically, late 19th century.
Okay. And the second question is just to add, maybe those mechanized robot-like scribes in Switzerland might be an interesting
That's 18th century, right? That's a great idea.
I think,
yes.
Because it's the stream of creating a robot as a mechanical help.
Right. And of course, there's Jefferson with his pen that follows along and so forth.
It don't exist.
Thank you.
I have two very different questions. One, I thought because you mentioned the scribes effacing themselves and the appeals to authority. And I wonder if one reason for the anonymity of the scribes is to protect the ability to appeal to an authority in that you can much more easily appeal to Aquinas for wisdom than to Aquinas' scribe.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That's the way in which even mentioning it there's a scribe is detracting potentially from the the authoritativeness of what you're getting. Although, in fact, with the Bible, yes, it's straight from God, but in fact, it was via the evangelists, they're safe, but then in fact it was via some other guys too who weren't safe. So right, as you say, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to say the Bible's perfect, then you sort of ignore the scribes, but if you want to correct the Bible, then the scribes are important to give you license.
This might be a very different one. For all the dependence of scholars on the scribes, I think that should have given the scribes some kind of negotiating power. And I wonder if you have a sense of, first, whether or not that's true, that they had any negotiating power, and second, what kind of things do you think they would want?
Right, that's a great question. So we do see a little tug between Erasmus and his favorite amanuensis near the end of his life, Gilbert Cousin, who leaves Erasmus's employ. And Erasmus tries to lure him back, and he promises him generosity, money. But what Cousin really wants is equality, I think. And I'll show an image that Cousin has of him working with Erasmus on an equal footing. But of course he doesn't go back, because I think he knows he's not going to get either. You know, a promise of generous gifts, and whereas he's got a job, he's got an ecclesiastical benefice. So Erasmus is, you know, angry, needling. He says, oh, your parents are neglecting your education by insisting you go back, as in, you will get more from hanging out with me, the great man, than you would from holding this ecclesiastical benefice. And then he talks, and then he has sort of flattering words for the young man. So the problem is they're replaceable, right? Although, obviously, after 5 years of service, and Erasmus got to be a pretty crotchety old man. He's 70 at the time of that interaction. And Cousin is 25. And actually, I'm sort of, you know, impressed with the backbone of Cousin, who just sort of says, ta-da, you know, to the greatest humanist in Europe, much older than he is. But on the other hand, I think he knew exactly where he stood, you know, that this was not a place with a future for him. There isn't that much negotiating power, ultimately, I think.
All right, time for one more. Well, two more. One more, and then that's it, and we'll break for our, I think Anne deserves.
I'd love to hear from you during the conversation.
Can I ask a question about this topic of the Islamic world?
Sure. I think some people in the audience may be better able to answer it than me. Exactly. Let's open it up.
I think in the 8th and 9th century, there was some suspicion of writing versus oral tradition, that
right.
writing was inferior, especially when it came to religious texts.
Right.
What was the role of the scribe in all that?
Basically, in the transition from orality to writing in the Islamic world, there was suspicion of writing as deleterious to not a good way of transmitting religious texts. And so the question is, what was the role of the scribe in there? In the Islamic world. Let's hold that thought. And I'll hear from you. Come, if you have answers, let me know and I'll convey. I have no idea. But actually, I do know someone, Beatrice Grundler, studies this kind of stuff. So that I can give you one reference.
Thank you, Anne. It was absolutely fabulous. I'll keep it very brief. Question about whether within the lexicographical, philological, etymological literature of your period, you find reflections on scribal and helping practice in works on the technical vocabulary of helping. So the etymology of amanuensis as a freed slave, or in the case of Hebrew, for example, whether you find the awareness that the root Ein, Zayin, Resh, Ezer, Azar, Ezra, the scribe, it's a homonym with an Aleph, it means Ezra, with an Hey, means helper, or help. So the name Ezra and the word help
Wonderful.
Are the same, are basically the same.
Super, thank you. In fact, the etymology given for amanuensis, typically, is helps with the hand, as opposed to a pedibus, would be a footman. And I don't know what's the accurate etymology, but so they do start, that's an 18th century source. That's a good question. I don't know. I should look in Calipino, shouldn't I? I certainly have looked in Bayerlink and so forth, and it's sort of, there's not a whole lot of attention to it. But that's a great point about Ezra. Thank you.